I thought if we kept him in Dreamblood, that would be enough. As superior, I have all but bathed in corruption. Yet always I have tried to keep it from soaking through my own skin. The good of the people, the will of Hananja, these things I have kept foremost in my mind. Corruption is a disease of the soul, Santai said. The superior had expected no mercy from him. But when he looked at Robina and saw the same hardness in the younger gatherer's eyes, he knew Hananja's judgment had fallen upon him at last. So be it. Tell us the rest of it, Superior, Robina said, very softly. Tell it all.
Dreamblood, the Superior said. In the end, it all comes down to that.
May her blessing wash me clean, he thought, as he began his final confession, and the Hedawa along with me. May I find the peace in Inakarek that I have never deserved. And may you, my gatherers, my brothers, find the strength to save us all.
Chapter 25. The shadows of Inakarek are the place where nightmares dwell, but not their source. Never forget, the Shadowlands are not elsewhere. We create them. They are within. Wisdom. The first half of the journey to Kiswa had been filled with routine, dawn waking and breakfast followed by 12 sweltering, mind and body numbing hours on camelback as they forged their way across the golden dune sea. But then had come Tessa, the halfway point, and after that the routine changed. A new sense of urgency seemed to have gripped Gehanu. She drove the caravan across the desert at a pace that left even the most experienced of the minstrels complaining at the end of the day. They began before dawn and finished well after sunset, stopping only when continuing would have threatened the camel's health. Najiri was thankful, despite his own exhaustion and soreness. Because of the brutal pace, few of the minstrels noticed Ehuru shivering despite the day's heat, or his unfocused stare, or the prayers that he continually murmured under his breath, a litany against the swirling chaos of sound and vision that had surely begun to overtake his mind. It was the beginning of the Pranje. Out here in the wild desert, miles from any center of civilization where a suitable tithe-bearer might be found, with no hope of privacy or solitude to ease the gatherer's suffering during Hananja's test, and surrounded by unbelievers, for even the Gujarin among the minstrels were the sort who worshipped Hananja only in word and not heart. They would not offer themselves to a gatherer's need, no matter how much they revered Hananja's highest servants. So what could Najiri do but lie beside Ehuru at night, whispering prayers to help him focus on reality? By day he rode alongside Ehuru, assisting his brother when he could, and using all his guile to turn aside the chance attentions of the minstrels. But as he'd feared, one among their party had already noticed. The Kisawati woman confronted him at the midday rest break. "What's wrong with him?" she demanded. They had begun to enter the scrublands that presaged Kisawa's northern border. The track of the goddess's blood meandered in lazy east-west loops at this point, which, along with the fact that travel south was against the current, was what had made the desert route the faster option. In another day they would cross the river at the Imsa Narrows, which marked the northern border of Sunandi's homeland. She will have power then. Najiri reminded himself of this as he accepted the canteen that she offered, her excuse for speaking privately to him. Since they would reach the river soon, he drank deeply before replying, grimacing at the brackish taste. "Too much time has passed since his last gathering," Najiri said, speaking quietly. He sat in the shadow of his camel, close enough to watch Ehuru, but not so close that the other caravanners would notice. She crouched across from him. "When will he become one of those things?" We do not speak of this to lay folk. She spat a stream of sewer at him, too fast for him to follow, although its gutter content was obvious. You will speak of it to me, she finished in Gujarin. Of course, she too had seen that the balance of power between them was shifting. They could still kill her, and would if Ehuru deemed her corrupt. But in her land that would bring the wrath of the protectors down on their heads. Najiri sighed. Gatherers are not like other men. The tithes we collect for the goddess change us. Surely you have heard of this in tales about our kind. Yes, you go mad if you don't kill. Why aren't you mad yet? Najiri felt his cheeks heat in a mingling of anger and shame. I'm only an apprentice. I've never collected dream blood. Ah, then answer my question. When does he change? He will not. Another Sua curse. Clearly, it has already begun. He would never permit himself to become such an abomination. He would die first. Najiri fought the tears that suddenly stung his eyes. He's dying now. If he were the monster you imagined, half this caravan would be dead already. Instead, he waits, enduring nightmares you cannot possibly imagine. Can you not see his suffering? She rocked back on her heels at his anguish. Najiri could read consternation in her eyes. What I see looks like madness. What does he wait for? Najiri bowed his head, telling himself fiercely that he would not weep before this unbeliever. Me, he whispered. You? I'm the only one here who can give him death in the proper manner, if I can manage it. My training is complete, but I have never... My narcomancy is... He was breathing too hard, his fists clenching. He took a deep breath to get control of himself. There's no way to practice gathering. When the time comes, the apprentice must simply do it. But to gather my mentor... Sanandi stared at him as he faltered and let the words fall away. Several breaths passed. In Gujara, it was considered proper to allow such silences and conversation. But Najiri had already realized this was not something foreigners did. If Sanandi was silent, it never indicated peaceful thoughts. I should attend him, Najiri said at last. He handed the canteen back to her and got to his feet. After tonight, I will be the one who goes with you to learn whatever your protectors can share of the prince's plans. Then I'll return to Gujara and destroy the Reaper. Hollow words. The monster would kill him, and they both knew it. But he could say nothing else, with grief still thick in his throat. She watched him, frowning, her anger visibly lessened. Why did he come on this journey? She asked. It seems foolish if he knew he wouldn't survive it. Najiri shook his head. A gatherer can endure without dream blood for several 8 days, as much as a full turn of the waking moon. But that's amid the peace and order of the Hedua, where the gatherer may pray and calm himself amid the contemplation gardens. Fear and danger devoured dream blood faster. He sighed unhappily. Ehuru's heart lacked peace to begin with because of his last gathering, which went badly. And then he met you, with your accusations against the Hedua. And then the Reaper attacked and forced him to use his last reserve to save me. He sighed, bowing his head. Gatherers need peace to thrive, in more ways than one. She stared at him for a long moment. Then she did something odd. She got to her feet, paced a few steps away, then paused and turned back. What does he need? What? To survive. Her lip curled as if the very words offended her, but she said, Can he be saved at this point? Najiri scowled. Do you expect me to believe you care? I care that making my case to the protectors will be easier if he stands at my side. She smiled thinly at Nijiri's look of affront. One of the dreaded gatherers of Gujara, the famous Ehuru himself, petitioning the Kiswati Protectorate for aid because he can no longer trust his own rulers? That will appeal to their vanity, as well as their reason, and add to my prestige. How dare you use him for your... He groped for the words, almost too outraged to speak. Your filthy, corrupt games! Lower your voice, little fool! He did so immediately, his anger chilling as he noticed the curious glances of the other caravanners and realized his outburst had been overheard. But he let his gaze show his loathing, glaring at the woman as he would never have done at a sister. If only he would revoke your abeyance, he said. He kept his tone gentle, though the words were vicious. That would save him. But he's too honorable to take even the likes of you without being sure of your corruption. She smiled, and in spite of himself, he was amazed by her steel. And I appreciate that consideration, she said, which is why I'm willing to help you save him. He needs death, yes? There's a hospital. Think of it as a temple, but only for healing and not worship. In the town of Tenasucha, just on the other side of the Kiswati border. I can bring him there. Speak to the healers. If he kills someone already dying, I may be able to justify that to the protectors. To save Ehuru, brother. Hope, after so many days without it, struck so fiercely that it seemed to burn in Najiri's belly. It must be someone willing to die. Otherwise he may refuse. Her eyes rolled. Willing, then, though a dying man should not be so picky. He's not like you. To a gatherer, death is a blessing. But not to you. She gave him a cold, knowing smile. He flinched. I've seen the way you look at him. You would do anything to keep him alive. So you shall take this chance, even though you despise me. And then you shall stand beside him in the Protector's Hall, and beg them for help, knowing that your every word increases my power. Then they will listen to me, even though I'm only Kinja's too young, unseasoned daughter. We must use one another now, little killer, if we are both to achieve our goals. Nijiri flinched at her words and their implications, far beyond the petty schemes she imagined. It was as the teachers, even lecherous omen, had warned him, those who consort with the corrupt eventually become corrupt themselves. Evil was the most contagious of diseases, so virulent that no herb, surgery, or dream humor could cure it. One's sense of what was normal, acceptable, became distorted by proximity to wrongness. Entire nations had succumbed this way, first to decadence, then collapse. Sunandi, and perhaps all Kiswa, was well advanced in the throes, and now she had spat this sickness onto Nijiri. Only his will would determine whether the sickness passed and left him stronger, or consumed him wholly. But he would keep others' needs foremost in his thoughts, as Gatherer Rabana had taught him. He would risk corruption, if that was what it took, to see that peace was restored and justice done, because that was what a gatherer did. And if it cost his soul to do so, well, at least he might save Ehuru. That alone would be worth it. So be it. He turned away to go tell Ehuru the news. Perhaps, knowing that this hospital was near, his brother could hold out a little longer. But then he stopped. Ehuru was on his feet. He had stepped out of the makeshift lean-to that the minstrels used to shield themselves from sun at the midday rest, and stood now facing north. To Najiri's eye, the deterioration was obvious in the way that Ehuru swayed slightly as he stood, and in the hollows of his face. He had no appetite these days, but his back was straight, and his eyes, though dimmed at the moment by a slight confusion, as though he doubted something he saw, were for the moment lucid. Najiri felt hope rise a notch higher. Surely Eohoru could last another day or two.
"Something is out there," Eohoru said suddenly. The minstrels glanced around at him in surprise. He took another step onto the hot, rocky sand.
"Someone is coming."
Najiri went to him, Sunandi forgotten as he touched his brother's arm and spoke in a low voice.
"Is it a vision, brother? Tell me what you see."
"Evil," Eohoru said. And for a sick instant, Najiri wondered if Eohoru spoke of him. But the gatherer's eyes were fixed on the horizon.
"No. Gods, no."
The Kisawati woman stood nearby. Najiri saw that her eyes, too, had fixed on the horizon. Puzzled, Najiri followed their gazes, and finally saw for himself a row of dust-shrouded specks amid the wavering heat lines, flickering and solidifying and flickering again, but growing closer.
"Evil and blood," Eohoru said, and then he turned to Najiri. "We should run."
Chapter 26. A gatherer shall submit himself to her test once per year. He shall purge himself of all tithes and travel between dreaming and waking, with only her favor to guide him. He shall endure in this state for 3 nights, or until death draws nigh. At the height of this test, he shall be attended by one who does not begrudge Hananja's tithe. If even once the gatherer claims her tithe for his own selfish desires, he shall fail. Law. In the borderlands between Inakarek and Honakarek, a voice whispers. For a time, Eohoru could ignore the voice, as he had long ago learned to do. Deny a vision, and it has no power. This one is easy to deny. It is soft, sometimes inaudible, rambling and gibbering when he can hear it. But it never stops, and every so often it says something so provocative that he cannot help responding. His words were full of lies. "Remember that I freed you. Love me. Forgive me. Serve me." "An Inket?" thinks Eohoru. "Perhaps." One lie. Another lie. The superior. The Kisawati woman, the law and wisdom of your faith, your brothers, all your brothers. No, I do not believe that. All your brothers, even the boy, brother, protector, lover, son. Najiri would never lie to me. I will listen to no more of this. A vision. He walks along the banks of the Blood at sunset, Kaitian gleaming atop its hill in the near distance. He is small. His mother holds his hand. He looks up at the woman he can no longer remember clearly, though parts of her linger in his mind. Skin smoothed as polished nightstone. A laugh rich like cattail wine. Eyes that are pools on a dreamerless night. Is she beautiful? She must be. For she is a foreigner, and yet has become the first wife of a king. He wishes he could remember more of her. "Soon," he says to her, a man's voice coming from his childish throat, "I will see you again, very soon." She looks at him, dark lips and graceful brows and blurred perfection, and he knows that she is sad. This troubles him for reasons he cannot remember. But when he opens his mouth to speak to her again, the words flee, and the thoughts jumble, and the vision is... "It is not real, brother." Eohoru blinks and sees darkness. Cold air goosebumps his skin. The dreamer's shifting light makes the dunes seem to roll like water in the distance. A warm body presses against his on the pallet. "Najiri." "I know," Eohoru says, though he is beginning to doubt that what he sees is not real.
His mind has begun to wander toward Inukkarek, and he knows better than anyone that the land of dreams is a real place with real power.
I want to be with my mother, he says, and the boy flinches.
Ehuru regrets inflicting pain in this manner, but Nijiri is a man by the laws of their people, a sworn servant of the goddess. It is time for him to face the responsibility of his role. At Kaition, you have never seen that palace, so I will describe it to you. And he does so, drawing on 100 memories from his childhood, embellishing its beauty unnecessarily. I can shape the rest, but it must be that place. She will be there, and I want to see her again. The boy's tears wet his skin. Do not ask this of me, brother. Please. But there is no one else, and they both know it. And even if their other brothers were available, he would choose Nijiri, for the boy loves him. That is the key, Ehuru understands now. Gathering is an act of love. Without that, it becomes something perverse. When Nijiri gathers him, there will be beauty more sublime than he has ever known. Because the boy has loved him for years, loved him through pain and beyond, loved him with a strength that pales the sun's love for the dreamer. He feels no shame at the thought of using that love for his own ends. It has always been a gift, freely given between them. The voice returns at mid-morning, when they resume their ride and monotony weakens the wall he has built to contain the madness. He ignores most of its ravings until it says, "The Kisawati woman is beautiful, is she not?" He is prepared for this. Lust is one of the first emotions to break free once a gatherer's dream blood reserves are drained. He ignores the voice and the image it plants in his mind, Sunandi lying on a red cloth, her long neck bent back for his lips, her full breasts ready for his hands, desire in her long-lashed eyes. There is a powerful stir in his loins, but this too he ignores out of long habit. Never once with a woman in your whole life. Why? Kisawari women know ways of preventing children. Children are the least of the prohibition, he thinks back irritably. There is also the danger of corruption, even greater with her. She lies for a living. The voice sounds triumphant, as if getting him to respond has been its private battle. No need for lies in bed, it whispers slyly. No need for speech. Just lay her down and spread her thighs and bury your troubles in her flesh. No. The voice bursts into laughter, harsh and mocking, because it knows that his refusal is not for lack of interest. It will try again later, when his will has weakened further, and he has become more susceptible to its suggestions. That is only a matter of time. Another vision. Fire dances along the horizon. The earth itself is burning. Inhumanly tall figures stride toward him amid the flames. Gods? But their faces are familiar. He gasps as he recognizes his brothers, Santai and Rabana and Unaune. But Unaune is dead. As he recalls this, he sees that his old mentor is smiling at him, but there is no affection in the smile, though they were all but father and son during the months of his apprenticeship. Instead, the smile is cold, cruel. Unaune turns his eyes downward, and when Ehuru looks, he sees that the god-gatherers walk not upon sand or rock, but bodies. The corpses lie sprawled and ugly, utterly without dignity, though to Ehuru's horror he sees sigils pressed into their flesh. Rabana's poppy, Santai's nightshade, Unaune's green orchid, his own oasis rose, stark and black. As he stares at the last, which rests upon the breast of a beautiful low-caste woman, Najiri's mother, O Hananja,
Una Une's foot comes down and crushes her chest. He hears bones breaking, sees clotted blood welling around his mentor's sandal, smells and tastes its stench. It is desecration of the most obscene kind, and he screams for them to stop.
They cannot, says a voice at his side, and he looks down into Najiri's solemn eyes. This is the gatherer way.
Ehuru jerks free of the vision quietly, some part of him recalling in time that he is surrounded by unbelieving strangers who will look askance at a man who starts screaming for no apparent reason. An overabundance of dream bile, he diagnoses as his pounding heart slows. A gatherer no longer produces dream blood on his own. When his reserves are empty, the mind increases the production of other humors in a hopeless attempt to compensate. The scholarly recitation helps him focus on reality, even as the sound of snapping bones still echoes in his ears.
Rest break, brother, Najiri says, ever the devoted attendant.
Ehuru nods, too hollow and numb to speak. He remembers to rein in the camel so that he can dismount. He goes through the motions of setting up his lean-to by rote. When he sits down in the shade, the shivers set in. He pulls his robes more closely about himself and concentrates on opening his canteen, praying that no one notices his shaking hands.
I cannot bear this much longer, he thinks, and looks up at Najiri as the boy comes to assist him with the canteen.
He will not plead. The boy must accept the duty on his own.
But soon, Najiri, please, soon.
Najiri looks into his face, and his own twists in anguish. Ehuru reaches up to touch his cheek, perversely wishing he had dream blood to soothe the boy's pain. But Najiri pulls away, and though his heart aches, Ehuru knows that this is necessary. Perhaps by putting distance between them, Najiri will find the strength to do his duty. It is an exceptionally cruel apprenticeship trial, but Hananja's will cannot be denied. Najiri is strong enough for it, Ehuru thinks with pride. The boy has always had a gatherer's soul. The boy goes over to crouch in the shadow of his camel, rocking back and forth a little as he wrestles with his conscience. Then the Kisawati woman goes over to Najiri with the canteen, and Ehuru wants to watch them, see if the boy manages to keep his temper this time. But he cannot, because another vision comes upon him, and it is so fierce that he cannot resist, and he sees blood and death blood on the sand, blood and fire, blood upon blood upon blood. Kill the Kisawati woman, kill the witnesses, kill them all except Ehuru. Bring him back in chains, in chains, in chains.
Slyly, the voice says, an Inket knows you have betrayed him.
I betrayed no one. When the abeyance ends,
delay, disobedience. He, she is the avatar. His word is her word, which is law. But there's still time. Kill the woman now, and she, he will be merciful. You can go back to the Hedewa. You can have peace again. The woman is young, but her life has been rich. Her dream blood will be sweet as you swallow it into your soul.
No, I cannot gather for selfish gain. That is an atrocity.
The atrocity is what will happen now, because of you.
Do not forget this, fool, beloved of Hananja. Real blood will flow because of you.
He looks up and sees death coming, a true seeing.
Reality returned, hard as a blow. Something is out there, he said. He felt no particular urgency as the words came. Someone is coming. Najiri was at his side immediately.
What do you see? The figures strode toward him from the horizon, immense, smiling, cold-eyed. They were evil, and he told Najiri so. Flight was the only option, though he sensed already that flight would be hopeless. "Break camp!" Gehanu cried. She ran through the milling minstrel folk, swift despite her bulk. "Quickly! We must go! Soldiers of Gujara!" The minstrel's confusion beat against Ehuru's mind, their questions against his ears. Why would soldiers of Gujara threaten them? Where had those soldiers come from? Ehuru did not know either, but someone did. There was no confusion in the Kisawati woman as she turned toward her mount. But as she did, her eyes met his and revealed her fear. "They mean to kill you this time," Ehuru told her. She flinched, then her lips quirked in a bitter smile. "I seem to hear nothing else from you, Gujarin, these days." Then she was gone, heading for her camel, and Najiri was tugging him toward his. Ehuru gripped the boy's arm. "I'll be fine," he said, and saw the boy's eyes widen at his sudden lucidity. He smiled tightly in response. A gatherer's will was a formidable thing. Najiri smiled back before nodding and sprinting toward his own beast. They mounted and whipped their camels to the loping canter that was their fastest run. The camels smelled their fear and obliged without protest. The Kisawati border was only a half a day's ride away. There was no way to tell how far back the Gujarin were through the heat haze, or even whether they had spotted the caravan. There was hope. "No, there isn't," laughed the voice in Ehuru's mind. When he glanced back again, the wavering specks on the horizon had resolved into clear shapes. Men on horseback. 4 fours or more, riding hard to catch up to them. The minstrels called out to one another in polyglot urgency, and all around Ehuru daggers and camel whips and the occasional short sword appeared. Then Gehanu called out something else, and the leaders of the caravan turned, dragging the rest to a halt. Instantly they began circling, backs to one another, weapons at the ready. Talithale's palanquin they set down at the center, along with the heavier of the trade goods, so as to make their mounts more maneuverable. To Sanandi, Ehuru heard Gehanu shout, "Go!" To which Sanandi replied, "I'll never make it!" "Try, damn you! We will hold them here!" But already Ehuru could see that the double line of horses had split, some veering to the east and the others west to flank them. The minstrels would never be able to hold all of the soldiers, and it would take only one to break off from the two-pronged attack and run Sunandi down. "Merrick's fires, they're not slowing at all!" Ehuru heard one of the minstrels gasp, and then the soldiers were upon them. Somewhere in the chaos that followed, Ehuru flung himself off the camel and rolled to his feet in the sand. He could fight better on the ground. A soldier rode at him with sword drawn. He braced himself. It took all his strength and skill to capture the flat of the blade between his hands when the soldier swung at his head. He threw his weight to one side and twisted the sword sharply. Surprise and momentum made the soldier lose his grip on the hilt as the horse rode past. Ehuru threw the blade aside, and then gasped as his sight blurred, another landscape superimposing itself on the present. A forest out of nightmare, ferns whose tendrils reached for him, palm fronds dripping poison. "No, not now, not— That one, damn you!" Ehuru pulled himself out of the vision to see a soldier on the other side of the chaos, reining in his horse to shout at the man who just tried to decapitate Ehuru. This one wore no livery. None of them did, but the stamp of the Gujarin military caste was plain in his sharp features and heavy jaw. Something in his manner hinted at command. "Orders are to bring him back alive." Then Ehuru had no more time for thought. Dust and cacophony filled the air, human cries mingling with animal panic and the clang of metal. Around him, life and death flickered in vignettes. Kehanu's son, Kanek, struggling to control his frightened mount, while a soldier bore down on him from behind. The singer, Anon, desperately using her precious harp as a shield, while a soldier hacked at it with his sword. A dancer, whose name Ehru did not know, screaming on the ground with his belly open and intestines laid out before him. His sight locked on the last. A gathering would be more merciful than the death the dancer faced now. Pivoting on his toes, Ehru stalked toward the man, the battle around him fading into so much background noise. "There are no sharers here," he whispered to himself. The words rang hollow, despite their truth. He pushed aside guilt and tried to focus on his duty. It must be done. But before he could reach the man, there was a flurry of something at the edge of his vision. A distraction. He ignored it. But then it moved into view, and he saw a soldier, horse wheeling away from a minstrel with a whip. "No!" And the dancer made no sound as the horse's hoof came down on his head. Brain and bone sprayed the ground, the essence of a man's whole self scattered to the dust. Ehru was not prepared for the rage. A flood of hatred so savage that his head pounded with it. But the soldier who had stolen his tithe-bearer had ridden off into the fray already. "Kill him," said the voice. And Ehru replied, "Yes, I shall." He ran after the soldier, silent, intent. Something moved across his vision and blocked his path. A different soldier brandishing a sword, words about surrender. He batted the sword aside and took hold of the arm that held it, ramming the heel of his free hand into the elbow. The wet pop of the breaking joint sounded like the head of the dancer, who might have been sentenced to an eternity in the Shadowlands by a soldier's carelessness. "I shall avenge you," he whispered to the dancer's soul, yanking the screaming, broken-armed soldier off the horse. The soldier kept screaming, writhing on the ground and holding the flopping ruin of his arm. Ehru contemplated him for a moment, then remembered that this was not the soldier he wanted. He stepped around the riderless horse and continued after his prey. Another soldier fell to the ground at his feet, choking and spitting blood. Najiri ran into view, poised to strike again, though he held the blow when he saw that the soldier was disabled. Ehru smiled at the sight. "Brother!" The boy was wild-eyed. "There are more soldiers approaching from the south. A Kisawati patrol. If we can hold out a bit longer..." He caught his breath and whirled away as another soldier rode at him. "Good," Ehru said, gliding onward. The boy was a gatherer. He could take care of himself. He spotted the soldier he'd marked near the center of the madness, perilously near to Lethale's palanquin. "You shall not," he whispered, and charged past a riderless camel to grab the man's leather half-torso under the arm. He hauled with all his weight, and the startled soldier tumbled to the ground, confused but still trying to raise his sword. Ehru stepped on the sword and put one knee on the man's chest to pin him down. Then he took hold of the man's hair and chin to break his neck. "Take him." He frowned, pausing. "For the goddess, a tithe was lost. Here is another." Around Ehru, the world was chaos. The soldiers had spotted the Kisawati patrol and were beginning to withdraw, harried by the surviving minstrels. Kehanu was on the ground, holding Kanek's body and screaming her grief. So much death and waste, the woman's corruption and the superior's lies, and a Ninket, he is a Ninket. "You should have trusted me," Ehru snarled at the face below him. The soldier's eyes widened. Then Ehru put his hand on the man's face. "Mother," and forced his eyelids shut. Hananja, I beg you for peace. And then he was inside the soldier, and the taste of dream blood was a sweet shock, like the first splatter of rain after a long drought. And after the taste, a torrent, he threw back his head and shouted in ecstasy, as the self of the soldier poured into the aching hollowness within him, sending life surging from his core out to the very tips of his fingers and toes. So delicious it was, so powerful that his head reeled and his groin throbbed and his scalp tingled, and oh, goddess, yes, he needed more, so much more that he shoved aside the soul to look for it. There was nothing left, save what little the soul needed to remain intact, but what did that matter? He snapped the tether, and sucked what spilled, and crushed the soul, and swallowed that too, and when nothing remained but tatters of mortal anguish, only then was he satisfied. And then horror smashed up from the depths of Eheru's consciousness, and shattered the bliss with a single word. The name for his sin, Reaper.
Chapter 27. Inanru, first gatherer and founder of Gujara, creator of narcomancy, father of healing. The details of his murder have been lost, like patterns in sand. Wisdom. As the soldiers bore down on them, Gehanu grabbed Sanandi's arm into the palanquin. Sanandi struggled to force her camel to turn. The anxious beast still wanted to run. Hide with a sick old woman? I'm not a coward! Don't argue with me, fool woman. Get in there and maybe you'll survive to warn your land. There was no arguing with that. Swallowing her pride, Sanandi dismounted and ran to the palanquin. Two of the minstrels were helping Talithale inside, piling saddlebags around the palanquin to help shield it. She joined them and climbed inside the flimsy cloth and balsa enclosure with the old woman. An instant later, the sounds of chaos erupted around them, shouts and clanging metal and the whistling of frightened camels. The palanquin shuddered with the vibrations of hoofs and bodies against the ground. Talithale caught her breath in fright, which turned into a racking cough. Sanandi helped her hold a cloth to her mouth, wrapping an arm around her for comfort and willing the pounding of her own heart to slow. But the sounds from without were too terrible to assuage her fears. Finally, for not knowing made the waiting worse, she pulled aside one of the palanquin's drapes to expose a sliver of outside and peeked through. Guidance of the protectors! Only a few moments could have passed since the beginning of the attack, but already the air was thick with dust and the stench of blood and worse. Just beyond the tent lay the body of one of the men who'd helped them into the palanquin. Beyond that, she saw another minstrel fall from his camel, screaming. An instant later she gasped in horror as a soldier ran him down. Gehanu ran past, screaming like a madwoman and brandishing a short sword with both hands. Then Sanandi's heart leaped into her throat as a soldier swung his horse around and narrowed his eyes at the palanquin, spotting her as she peered through the curtain. We must go. Hooking an arm around Talithale, she put her shoulder under the old woman's arm. She was light as a child, and hauled her out of the palanquin's other side, struggling to climb over the saddlebags. Behind them she could hear the beat of hooves, all but sense the soldier's malice directed at her back as he drew closer, closer yet, close enough to run her through. There was a horse's sharp squeal of protest from behind her. She put her hand on the ground to brace herself and hauled Talithale over a sack of fruit. The earth gave a hard shudder against her palm as something heavy landed nearby. She struggled to her feet and saw. The soldier's horse was dead. So was the soldier, lying sprawled across the now smashed palanquin, his neck broken. Above the soldier, his fists still clenched, Najiri stared down at the body with something like shock on his face. Sunandi helped Talithale upright and tried to catch her breath. "Little killer," she said between pants, "how fortunate for me that you are." He flinched and glared up at her, anger displacing the shock in his diluted brown eyes. Then his face hardened, turning as cold as his mentor's. "Stay with me," he told her. "Carry the elder, and I'll protect you both." She wanted to refuse him, but pragmatism, and the scream of another horse as it went down nearby, outweighed pettiness. Nodding, she lifted Talithale in her arms and moved behind him, trying not to crowd against him in her terror. He stayed where he was, keeping the palanquin debris and piled baggage at their backs, crouching in some sort of defensive stance. But when Sunandi looked around, she was relieved to see there would be little need of the boy's skills. Although the caravan clearly had been on the losing side of the battle, their attackers were beginning to withdraw, calling alarms to one another and looking southward in visible agitation. Sunandi followed their sight and spied another party of riders drawing near, trailing a dust plume in their wake and bracing the green and gold wooden shields of the Protectorate to the fore. Relief nearly brought tears to her eyes. Abruptly, Najiri stiffened and whirled, looking not toward the Kiswahili riders, but off in a completely different direction. "Stay here," he told her, and before she could protest, he went running off. She saw him halt beside Ehuru, who sat slumped on his knees beside the sprawled body of another soldier. But she had no more time to puzzle this out as the rescue party arrived. The Kiswahili riders split, the bulk of the troop continuing on in pursuit of the Gujarin, while a four veered off and slowed to ride among the minstrels. Sunandi glanced down at Talithale, torn. "Put me down," the old woman whispered. Her voice had gone hoarse. "I will be fine." After another moment's hesitation, Sunandi crouched and helped Talithale to lie down amid some sacks of northern herbs, whose savory fragrance did little to cover the smell of death around them. They had left all their lean-tos behind when they broke camp, so she pulled some of the mangled palanquin debris over the pile and jammed one broken pole into the ground, hooking a cloth over its end to give the old woman some shade. Then she turned and raised her fists. One of the Kiswahili riders, a lean, large-eyed man with a slashing scar across his face, spurred his horse over to her. "I am Sunandi J. Kalawe, first voice of the Protectors assigned to Gujara," she called as he drew to a halt. She lifted the sleeve of her robe to reveal the gold band around her bicep, detaching the polished half-orb of agate set into it as a decoration. Its flat side was inscribed with a formal pictorial of a stylized double moon above four trees, the mark of passage granted to all Kiswahili high officials. He raised his eyebrows and said, "You're a long way from your assignment, Speaker. What happened here? These aren't the usual bandit scum." "Gujarin soldiers."
"Gujarin? But how?"
"I believe there may be a garrison hidden somewhere in the desert." She stepped closer, reaching up to put a hand on his saddle. "They attacked to stop me from bringing that secret back to the Protectors, but I have more secrets to deliver, all equally important." His eyes widened, then hardened. "You shall deliver them, Speaker. When my captain returns, I'll tell him, and we will escort you to make certain of it."
"These people need help first. They—" Grief and guilt struck then, and she bowed her head. "They have suffered much because of me."
The lieutenant nodded and signaled his three riders to begin aiding the wounded. Sunandi assisted as much as she could, moving among the minstrels to perform the unpleasant task of sorting the all-but-dead from those who could still be saved. You're not to blame, Nefe. Gehanu's voice drew Sanandi out of the numbness. Kanek lay dead across Gehanu's knees, his chest a mass of red. Tear tracks had dried on Gehanu's cheeks. The people behind this don't care what they unleash to get what they want. We were just in their way. Sanandi sighed and turned away. Barely 2/4 of their party survived, a third of the number that had started out from Gujara. Like a pittance from the gods in compensation for their earlier cruelty, many of the wounded would survive, thanks to the Gujarine in their party. Najiri revealed to the others that he was a servant of Hananja, and asked for tithes of humors to help heal the wounded. He could perform only simple healing, closing wounds, easing shock, but even that much helped greatly. The three Gujarine minstrels who'd survived immediately let him put them to sleep and siphon whatever he needed from their dreams. He did not tell them what sort of servant he was, Sanandi noted, and they did not ask. Nor did they censure him for lying to them, for servants of Hananja often went in disguise for various reasons. The power of faith, even in Gujara's expatriate children, was strong. A Kisawati troop returned to report that the Gujarine soldiers, after a pitched battle, began to turn their swords on themselves when it became clear they would lose. Those who hesitated were cut down or shot by their captain, who managed to mortally wound himself before they disarmed him. He died as they tried to question him. "Those two will be accompanying me as well," Sanandi said, nodding toward Ehiru and Najiri. Ehiru sat on some baggage nearby, slumped in apparent exhaustion. Najiri crouched near him, offering him water. The boy glanced around as they spoke, listening. The captain assessed them in a glance and narrowed his eyes in suspicion. "Gujarine?" "Yes. I have promised to present them to the protectors. They might be assassins." Sanandi smiled thinly. "I assure you, they are not." The captain looked at her for a long moment, then nodded. "There are plenty of extra horses from the Gujarine troop. We'll need some to carry the bodies, but you and your companions may have one each. The rest I'm giving to this caravan to compensate them for their losses." "I thank you," said Gehanu, overhearing and coming over. Her face was dry now, but its lines had deepened. She looked old and tired. "That will help." "Gehanu?" Sanandi groped for something to say. Gehanu gave her a weary smile, reaching out to grip her shoulder. "Go," she said. "Suffering and death are part of life. We'll be fine." Sunandi's throat tightened. "My fault." She began to turn away, mourning Kanek, and mourning her friendship with Gehanu, since it could hardly survive such a blow. But Gehanu made a sound of irritation and abruptly pulled her into a tight embrace. Sanandi stiffened, then could not help bursting into tears as the captain tactfully withdrew behind them. "You're still the daughter of my heart," whispered Gehanu. She was trembling, Sanandi noticed, trying very hard not to cry herself. "That will never change." When Gehanu finally released Sanandi, she pulled away reluctantly, remembering the night when a foreign trader had given shelter to a street child whose incompetence at thievery had gotten her beaten nearly to death. That trader had brought the child, a bright and pretty girl with no future, to the notice of an old Shunha nobleman with no heirs. He had renamed her and raised her to do battle with kings, but the street child had never forgotten that first kindness. "You're still a meddling old bat," Sanandi said back. Gehanu gave a rusty chuckle and shook her head. "Kinja never could tame you, wild child. Go on now." Reluctantly, Sanandi turned away. Not far off, Ehiru had mounted his horse, and Ajiri stood near his. Another horse had been saddled for her, and she pulled herself onto it now, feeling a moment's pang as she gazed southward. That way lay home, at a storm of trouble when the protectors learned of Gujara's plotting. Trouble? Say war and be truer. She glanced over at Najiri. It took him a moment to notice her gaze. He was staring at his mentor. When he finally did turn, she was stunned at the bleak despair in his face. Then he noticed her gaze, and his expression became a cool, professional mask. "We must see this through, Jay Kalawe," he said. Sunandi frowned, wondering what troubled him. The soldier he killed? He was trained to kill, but not so brutally. Then she looked beyond him at the slumped, hooded, too-still frame of Eiru and guessed. Well, at least we won't have to waste time going to the hospital now. After the long, bloody day, and facing a far uglier future, that was the most comforting thought her tired mind could dredge up. The captain called the march, and they spurred their horses toward Kisua. Chapter 28. The prince protects Hona Karek, as the Hedawa protects Ina Karek. Law. Yanya Ion's audience chamber was nearly empty when Sharis entered through its bronze doors. The dais at the far end, a mounting series of steps leading up to the throne, was normally thronged with courtiers and worshippers. Now it held only the prince, who stood with arms extended as two of his attendants dressed him in the full torso armor that was the sunset's traditional wartime garb. A third servant held the aureole in place behind him, shifting it as he turned. "Ah, Sharis, please report." Sharis knelt at the foot of the steps. "No word from the south yet, my lord. The attack would only have occurred yesterday evening. It would take time for the troops to return and send a bird or runner." Well, whether the woman is dead or not, she may have sent a message. We shall have to assume the Kisawati forewarned. He turned, the bronze scales of his breastplate gleaming, his arms still held out from his sides. "Do I look suitably martial, Sharis? Not military caste, of course, but acceptable?" "More than acceptable, my lord. You will inspire our soldiers to fight to their utmost." "Spoken like a true high caste." The prince lowered his arms, gave himself one final look before the mirror that a fourth attendant held, and nodded in satisfaction. Dismissed, the servants quickly left the chamber, save the aureole holder. "I have no need of flattery, Sharis." Nias understood that. "In time, I hope you will as well." Sharis took a deep breath to school his churning emotions. "Yes, my lord." "Of course, there are benefits to having a general like you, too, Sharis. You ask no awkward questions. Give me no disapproving looks. I suppose that's refreshing." Walking down the steps with the aureole holder in tow, the prince gave a curt signal for Sharis to rise and follow. They passed through the back of the hall, Sharis nodding to the sunset guardsmen who fell in behind them as the prince left the chamber. "In the end, loyalty is what matters most," the prince continued. "Take our mad, murderous friend, who is currently chained and resting in the catacombs beneath the palace. He doesn't think, not anymore. He doesn't act unless I tell him to, or unless he's hungry and prey comes near. In many ways, this limits his usefulness. But at the same time, I never need fear his betrayal. There are kings who struggle all their lives to earn that kind of loyalty, and here I have created it, at will." He chuckled. "True power, Sharis. My father and all the princes before me never had it, but I shall." The audience chamber was on the highest story of Yanya Ion. When the prince led him onto the royal family's private balcony, Sharis caught his breath at the sight of the whole city spread before them. the ground so far below that the people milling in the market plaza seemed small as dolls. To the west was the river and the fertile greenlands, source of Gujara's prosperity. Northward, Sharas could even see the river delta and the coastal edge of the Sea of Glory,